Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your touch-tone phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. David Prosper. Thank you. You may begin.
Hey, thank you, and hi, everyone. This is me, Dave Prosper, from the NASA Night Sky Network here at the Astronomical Society of the Pacific in a surprisingly rainy San Francisco, California. I'm really excited to present this teleconference with our guest speaker, Dr. Mandeep Gill from the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. Before we begin, I just want to make sure that you can all have the presentation slides ready and ready to view. So if you don't have the slides up in front of you yet, you can download them at bit.ly/NSNLensing. That's bit.ly then /NSNLENSING. And if you have any problems along the way, feel free to email us at nightskyinfo@astrosociety.org. Now, for a brief minute, I'd like to hear from the folks joining us tonight. So, operator, if you could please open up the lines, and if you all could just give us your name and tell us where you're calling from and what club you're with, we'll have an idea of who's out there listening. Operator?
Thank you. Lines are now open.
Cook Feldman with St. Louis Astronomical Society.
From Jackson, Michigan.
Bill Wagner, Berks County Amateur Astronomical Society, Reading, Pennsylvania.
A high school astronomy teacher in St. Louis, Missouri.
Terry Adams, Miami Valley Astronomical Society in Dayton, Ohio.
Greg Donahue, Celestial North, Seattle, Washington.
Willie Yu from the Mid-Hudson Astronomical Association.
Nanette Benoit, Gloucester Area Astronomy Club, Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Ronald Rennie, South Bay Astronomical Society in Torrance, California.
Harry Treese, Astronomical Association of Southern Illinois, Carbondale, Illinois, crossroads of the next two solar eclipses.
Awesome. Michael O'Toole, a really interested astronomy kid.
Awesome. We'll just thanks everyone for checking in, and we'll just Great to hear from you all. And so, to follow along with our talk, just follow along with the PDF of slides, and there will be a time for a Q&A at the end of our talk. And now we have just a brief minute for the latest Night Sky Network news for our members. This is actually going to be some pretty great news. We've recently rolled out some more updates to the site behind the scenes that should help both speed up the club events calendar, the way it renders and sometimes doesn't, and help with finding your location while still maintaining your privacy. So those things should be working much better for most folks now. And we're also close to the end of our survey of amateur astronomers. If you haven't taken our survey yet, we ask you to do so very soon. You can find that survey at bit.ly/2014astrosurvey. And our results will be published in a couple of months, along with an update in Sky and Telescope magazine. And also, it's near the end of the third quarter, so remember to log your events for chances to win our next quarterly prize, as well as to receive some additional or replacement toolkits if your club has not already received them all. So now let's get started with tonight's talk. It is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Mandeep Gill from the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, or SLAC. His topic tonight is Cosmology from Gravitational Lensing, or Professor Einstein Teaches Us About the Cosmos Through Its Space-Time Curvature. Dr. Gill is going to take us through a tour through the universe of the very big and very small and show us the links between particle physics here on Earth and the warping of space-time that enables us to see on the very large scales of our universe and answer some questions about the very small via the very large. Dr. Gill is a member of the Public Affairs Department and is an observational cosmologist at SLAC, concentrating on gravitational weak lensing. In 2008, he was a postdoc research fellow at the Center for Cosmology and Particle Physics at The Ohio State University, concentrating on gravitational weak lensing and determination of cosmological parameters from this technique. He earned his doctorate at UC Berkeley in 2004 in experimental high-energy particle physics. In the summer of 2005, he visited the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, and observed, or one may even say was awed by, the construction of the CMS and ATLAS experiments. In a visiting position at Caltech in 2006, he was involved in a cosmology project involving second-order weak lensing, and ultimately better dark matter distribution determination of distant galaxy clusters. And so, Dr. Gill, with that, would you like to begin?
Yes, indeed, David. Hope everyone can hear me well. Welcome, everyone. It's a great pleasure to talk to you all tonight. And David, just let me know if you can hear me or anything. It was great to hear where everyone is from. This is a very interesting format for me. First time I've done this, and I think it's pretty neat. As you've heard, I've been in different parts of the country, and so it's neat to hear people from, you know, the South Bay of down in LA and Dayton, Ohio, where I was near there for a few years and all that. So I'm going to try to keep this talk kind of compact, a little bit more than I normally would. So we might skip a few slides, and I actually have taken out some of the particle physics because I actually prefer questions more. So keep the questions in your mind, because so I'm going to try to keep this to about 40 minutes of the talking part early on. They are in the backup slides, so think about it as we go through. So I'm going to go ahead and start. The title you've seen is a little bit different now. It's how Herr Dr. Einstein can come to the rescue and help us solve the grandest mystery in modern day physics. Okay, so let's go ahead to the second slide. They have numbers in the PDF at least, and I've usually given this as PowerPoint. It won't have any transitions now, but that should be okay. So for more info, you can find a link that gives you a lot more resources at the top of mandeep.org. It's my website, and you can mail me personally if you have more questions, and you can like this page and ask more questions at the Facebook link there if you are so inclined. Great. So with that, we'll go to page 3, and so the talk plan is to talk a little bit about dark matter, dark energy. Bring it to Earth for a minute, because it's kind of big going way out there. Introduce lensing, and then how lensing can help us with dark matter and dark energy, and talk a little bit about the future in this field. Okay, slide 4 is some of my inspirations. I always like to bring in Carl Sagan, our sort of patron scientist, you could say. I really like his work. In fact, when I give this talk, I show the pale blue dot video, and won't have time here, but I really recommend looking that up. I'll mention it again at the end. So I also like the new cosmos by Neil Tyson. A lot of people like that too, but Carl was my and many people's first inspiration. So being in nature, I'm in nature a lot. This is a place where I give this talk actually at that farm, and it was dark by the time I finished, and we just looked up and taking us to the third thing, which is looking at the night sky, which a lot of you do. And, you know, astronomy, unlike particle physics where I got my PhD, which is harder to access in some ways, astronomy, the sky is always up there, you know, so there's this intrinsic thing. And I just tell people who feel so divorced, I'm like, you know, find the Big Dipper first. You know, just get your hands around that. And that if you start knowing some of the stars, most of you know that's Orion there, they'll be your friends. They're always there, you know. So that's where I start, and I like to ground it in that. All right, so slide 5. Again, particle physics and cosmology have reconverged, and I can talk about that more later if people ask. So slide 6 is where SLAC is. So some of you may live near SLAC, and SLAC may be actually starting to re-begin tours soon. But SLAC is a particle physics lab, and so if in the figure on the left there, when you you're looking west, we accelerate electrons and anti-electrons, and we start them at the top there, where it says looking west, and bring them down. And we just have a fixed target program. And then we had a collider, so the building, the rectangular building, close to the bottom of the of that picture on the left, that's a huge building in which there's a, we call it the collider hall. And we used to collide them at very high energies, finding the third most massive particle that we know of after the top quark and the Higgs boson. So at that time, it was the heaviest mass particle in the early 90s. Anyway, so it's done a lot of particle physics. And so how does that connect to astro at all? Well, so if you go to slide 7, astrophysics, you are scaling up, you know, these sort of telescopes you use in the backyard. So there you see Fermi and Chandra. These are two telescopes that are used in space. So the specifically Fermi, that gamma ray telescope there, gamma rays are some of the particles that come out when you collide particles together. They're very high energy photons. And we had an expertise at SLAC in building crystals that would detect those gamma rays. And so when you fly them in space, we made those into an instrument that we could fly in space, since we had expertise, because they don't penetrate very far into the atmosphere, so you have to go into space for that energy of photon, and we can see them up there. And you can see things like gamma ray bursts, which are super-powered supernova that are beamed at us, and disks, you can see black holes and gamma rays and different. We're looking for dark matter indirectly if it has a gamma ray signature, the annihilation of dark matter. Anyway, so we had expertise, and that's where sort of the, one of the connections between particle physics and astro came from. All right, if we go to slide 8, another place is, so this is the history of the universe on one slide. So towards the left, you know, we're just showing a schematic in time going from the left to right. And so as you also go back in time, if you look on the bottom there, the top row is time, the middle row is temperature, the bottom row is energy. So we're going up in energy, and, you know, even if you don't know what a GeV, one GeV, a proton weighs about 1 GeV in equivalent units, so just to get some scale. So our current universe is very low energy. You can see 10 to the minus 13 or so GeV. But then when you went back to, you know, much less than a second, at 10 to the minus 10 seconds, you're at 100 GeV. And what you see is, I'm sort of going left and right and back, but early on you see all these letters. Those were individual particles. Over time, the quarks and all those coalesced into nuclei, into neutrons and protons, which went into nuclei, made atoms. The electrons started going around the nuclei. They made atoms. Then you made galaxies, and you made the Thinker, for example, at a billion years, close to 10 billion years, you had the Thinker, finally, by Rodin. And so that's a connection that early universe physics, you have to do a lot of particle physics in early, you know, just after the Big Bang singularity. You have to understand that particle physics, so just how particles interact, because there's no galaxies back then. There's nothing but particles. So there's many connections and between the two. So let's go to slide 9. And some of you may have seen a pie chart, but I like the cupcake picture, if not charts, the cupcake picture. And this is a colleague of mine who liked to bake, so she chose to use cupcake analogy. So this, in one cupcake-like chocolatey picture, encapsulates all what we know about the composition of the universe. And we understand this well. We understand what the universe is, what the slices are made of, pretty well now, even if we haven't pinned down what the components are. But what this shows is the body is made of something called dark energy, and I'll explain that in a minute. The frosting is dark matter. It's about a quarter of the matter energy content, so I'll use this term, matter energy content. And the sprinkles are what we're made of, and it's actually mostly hydrogen, and it's just 4% of the matter energy content. And I say matter energy because through equals mc squared, matter and energy do have this equivalence. Okay, so that's, we understand that division well. And this was not understood 20 years ago or really even 15. This is a pretty, especially that dark energy, that was only pinned down as being a major component 15 years ago, 1998, so 16 years ago. We didn't know that before that. So when I was going to school as undergrad, that was not known. Great. So now we go on to figure 10. This is saying it in a different way. This is the sort of typical pie chart that we use, and it shows the dark energy, dark matter, and then the sort of normal matter broken into the different components. And you can see that breakdown. Okay. And now we're going to go on to slide 11. This is only going to be the only equation slide. So for those of you who are, you know, okay with equations, what we have, I want to explain why we believe in dark matter. I get a little bit of a, you know, because we hear about it all the time. You know, some people think we just make it up, but really, in 1689, Newton explained the motion of the planets with these equations. So there's basically the first equation is Newtonian gravity. So G is a constant, M and capital M, small m are the two objects. D is the distance between the objects. And the other equation below it is F equals ma, law of inertia. And so you just combine those two equations, and you will get the lower equation. The A equals F over M equals V squared over D is for circular motion. You get that form. So the important thing to recognize in that last equation is the velocity goes as capital M there is the mass of the central object, the sun. So if I'm at a fixed radius, so if D is fixed, the more massive the object is, the central object, the faster V has to be in that circular orbit. Or conversely, if I take a fixed mass object and I go out in distance, that object can go slower or will go slower to stay in the same orbit. So Mercury rips around the sun in 88 days. We take 365 Earth days. Pluto, the dwarf planet, takes several years. I forget the number, 13 possibly. It's over 200. Sorry, I was thinking the other big gas giants. So, for those who didn't like Pluto being demoted, the New Horizons spacecraft will be getting there next year, so we'll have lots more interesting info, by the way. So the point here is, as you go out in distance, you feel the gravity of the central object less, so you don't have to go as fast to sort of stay in orbit. At an infinite distance, you can just sit there and you wouldn't feel it. Now, if we go to the next slide, 12, we see what I show there are the velocity vectors of the different planets, so going from in to out. These are just the inner rocky planets, the four rocky ones. You can see the velocity vectors fall as they go out from Mercury to Mars. Now, slide 13. So in galaxies, we didn't expect an immediate fall-off because galaxies don't have just one central object. They have a lot of gas and dust and stars that keep going out for a while. You know, you see this all the time. You see this in a spiral galaxy if you see it face-on like that. And you might expect the velocity has to go higher for a while because you're including more and more mass within your radius. But then it's got to start falling off when the matter gets diffuse. Certainly beyond the very diffuse outer edge, it should fall. That's what you expect. This is what people expected. But what they saw was slide 14, the green arrows, that when they measured tracers, the tracers, which are stars if you can see them, and gas clouds as you get beyond the edge, kept having a higher velocity, a constant velocity. And we see that schematically in the next plot, page 15. So I have plotted there, I have a plot of velocity versus distance. So So the dash curve is what we expected, as I showed before, and the red is the observed curve that people actually saw. Okay, and so we infer that there is some other kind of matter that we can't see in visible light directly. The evidence is all from gravity. And the next plot, page 16, shows actual plots. So again, rotational velocity on the vertical axis, distance from the center in this unit called kiloparsec. So it's a kiloparsec is 1 kiloparsec is 3,000 light years. So our galaxy is, you know, 50,000 light years across in diameter or something roughly like that. So you get some sense of it. You see this repeatedly in all these galaxies. This is really the clincher, and it's where it's one of the easiest places to understand dark matter. Okay, so a lot of people at this point say, well, what about, couldn't it just be planets you don't see or things, black holes you don't see? And people have actually searched in very many ways for those indirectly through lensing, through their gravitational influence on each other. And I'll just say simply for now here that there's very strong evidence that that is not the case, that they're not made of normal, that whatever the dark matter is not normal matter. And slide 17, I show a few other places where it's indirectly, quote, seen. So it's seen in these rotation curves of the velocity rotation curves of the galaxies, as I just showed. In all these other, and on the top in green, in all these other sort of different astronomical observables, we call them. It's a cosmological component, the lower pie chart, because, as I'll show, you need it to make, to get the large-scale structure right, that is, to get the distribution of where galaxies are right. And we're searching for it in colliders. It, you know, there's theoretical reasons it could be there in certain models, but that's not guaranteed to us that that's true. So we don't really know that. So just jumping straight to dark energy, this figure is kind of supposed to show that the universe was for a while slowing down. So you see first it had this huge Big Bang, so the time is vertical axis now, and then the expanding universe there is supposed to show the radius of the observable universe. It's, you know, so the orange and then the blue, it's expanding, but it's slowing down. And then suddenly when it goes black, it starts getting bigger, faster. It's an accelerated expansion. Things are not any just moving away from us with the velocity and slowing down. They're moving farther. That was the observation that was made in 1998, okay? And that won the Nobel Prize in 2012. Because it's extremely strong evidence now from many different sources that I can talk about if people want to know. It was first found in supernovae, which are standard candles, but it's seen in many different arenas. And the simplest explanation for that, we don't really, you know, what I say is dark energy is a stand-in for our ignorance of, you know, why this is happening. The next page, 19, slide 19, shows sort of one model. There's this thing called the Casimir effect, which happens because there's virtual particles popping in and out of the vacuum. I'm using a lot of words here that are, there's this, you know, foaminess to space-time. And so if you want to know more, you can go again to the Extra Cosmo resources. But essentially, these are all theoretical ideas, and there's no really great idea. What the simplest idea is, there's these equations. I should probably put them in. They're called the Einstein equations, and they are what describe gravity to us. Fully in our universe, we understand all gravity through the Einstein equations. And Einstein knew that if he put in a constant, he could get a steady state universe. So that's what he did back in the 1900s, before Hubble knew had seen the expansion. So that's the simplest way we still do it. So and lambda is the constant term that Einstein used in his equations. So if you go to figure 20, that's the Greek letter lambda at the top. And it's sort of what this is showing, scale size is showing sort of how fast things are expanding, and again, time on the horizontal axis. And you see an inflection point at, between 10 and 14 billion years. Instead of slowing down, the universe starts speeding up, and that's what's happening now. ABB is after Big Bang there. So that's what we're seeing, and the simplest explanation is a constant. Now, why should it be a specific value, this constant energy density? There's no real understanding of that. You know, some people say multiverse, we're one of gazillions of universes, and it was, we're the right one for that. I don't think that explains a lot, and, that's theoretical prejudice. Or anyway, this is a very active area of research, let's say. So the telescopes I work on are looking at these kinds of things. So if you go to figure 21, another place we see dark energy, and you also need dark matter to get this right, is these the structure of matter in the universe. It's the distribution of galaxies and the filaments in between them that are made of gas and dark matter. We don't see the dark matter, but we can infer it from different ways. So on the left in that plot, on that slide, we see a universe with dark energy. On the right, we see a universe without dark energy. It is very different in that slide. And one without dark matter would also be very different. On slide 22, when you actually compare data and simulations, they're very close if you put in this dark matter and dark energy. I'm sort of, not showing ones that would be really different here, but you can find those easily out on the web, or what it would look like. So this is the kind of thing that has really convinced people that we understand well, that we have the composition right, even if we don't have, quote, the details of knowing what the dark matter particles are, what sets the scale of dark energy. So 23, I'm going to step back a step. Sometimes people take a sigh here, so that's good if you want to do that. I just want to give this sense of scale, because I went out way to the edge of the universe there. Okay, so just for, to get some sense of scale, I'd like people to know, the speed of light is very fast to us. So the fastest low Earth orbit satellites go at 30,000 kilometers per second. The elapsed time it's about 90 minutes to go around the Earth, and light goes around about 8 times in 1 second around the Earth, right? It's really fast. The next slide before shows some important distances in light time. So the Earth's circumference, a little more than a tenth of a light second. The Sun is about 8 light minutes. Alpha Centauri, a lot of people know, is about 4 light years. The Milky Way center is about, from us, about 30,000 light years. So the diameter, I'm understated, it's closer to 60 or 70,000 light years across. The Andromeda Galaxy is the farthest object you can see with your eyes, 2.6 million light years away, little smudge, until you look at it with a telescope. And the limit of the observable universe, beyond which we can't see in light, is 13.8 billion light years, giga light years, right? So these are, when I'm looking at galaxies, they're very far away. They're usually hundreds of millions to billions of light years away. So people often ask me about planets and things, and I'm like, well, that's interesting, but not what I work on, my friends. So if we go to 25, we're going to now step into lensing a little bit. So we're going to talk about what it is. So slide 26, what does gravity do? Holds us to the Earth. 27, holds the Earth in orbit around the Sun, and it bends light. 28. so what we have there is a schematic, And you may have seen these kind of rubber sheet schematics. You know, it's an imperfect analogy, but in two dimensions, if you warp a rubber sheet, then you know, a ball sort of will roll that was normally going to go straight will sort of curve as it goes, dips into the well and out, okay? You often see these in these coin wells that you have at popular science museums. And so massive objects bend light. They really bend light. I mean, so all objects that have any mass bend light, but on the Earth, light travels fast and is very little. So you need a big object to bend light a lot. So the first place this was seen, so slide 29, Newton's law of gravity, you can calculate what would happen to a beam of light if it passed by a massive object. And slide 30 shows, because a lot of times people say this is only an Einsteinian effect. The interesting thing is the Einstein equations have a factor of 2 relative to Newton. So it's an interesting factor of 2. So, you know, if you just say light is bent by gravity in proportion to how massive the equivalence equals mc squared, light is an energy, what if it had the same mass, how would it be bent, you can get a bending, and the only effect the only sort of further effect from Einstein is this factor of 2. So Sir Arthur Eddington went out and said, let's see what we see. So I'm going to show you a couple of schematics. So slide 31, you can see that if the light bends by the sun, it will look like it came from a different direction, right? Because we think light goes straight. Normally in our real life, other than refraction, that's true. And so in 1919, Eddington went out, and he went out during an eclipse when something would cover the sun, when the moon would cover the sun, so you could look very close to the edge, the limb of the sun, and you can see the no lensing, the open circles, is where we knew certain stars would be, but with lensing, they actually were farther away. They actually all looked like they were farther from the central object. That was a really big deal when that happened. That's when Einstein was very celebrated. So that was the first observation of lensing. And then there was a development on slide 34 of the idea that gravity can act as a lens. And in 1936, Professor Einstein said, certain things, if they go by even more powerful gravitational sources like black holes, you might get multiple images because light could go be bent in different directions, and that's what he said. But he concluded, of course, there is no hope of observing this phenomenon. So basically, even a very bright friend of ours said this would not happen. But then, going to slide 36, what we're going to see is that when gravity lenses light, the images are distorted and magnified. So what does it look like? So this is kind of cool. This GravLens 3 app is publicly available for the iPhone only by a Kaipak person. Kaipak is at Slack. It's where I work. And so it was made by Eli, and you can get that and check it out. It's kind of cool, actually. So slide 37 shows how you could get multiple images if light is bent around a massive galaxy or a massive black hole or whatever in two different directions. And so that was observed on slide 38. You can see two images, and that was observed for the first time in, I think it was in the 70s, it was seen because we were able to get telescopes powerful enough to image that resolution. And the way that we knew it was the same object, by looking at the spectrum, and so then we can say it was the exact same initial quasar. So if you're looking at a galaxy, slide 39, what happens is, and there's another galaxy in the way, slide 40, what will happen is the light will be bent all around, and you will get an arc, or an Einstein ring, And we actually see those. That's a really spectacular image. That's a real image that you're seeing there in 41. So in 42 is one of my colleagues, Debbie. And so we're going to see what this, if you use that GravLens app, what would happen to her. So in 43, if you put it away from her head, so she's behind, right? And that sun now, the source, is in front, but it's already distorting poor Debbie. She doesn't look well there. But if you go to slide 44, we say, oh, my goodness, she really needs to go to the doctor. If the sun was right, if the star or whatever the very strong lensing object was right, you know, in front, you would get something like that where, like we saw before, the whole galaxy becomes a ring around it. So it becomes very distorted. So, again, 45 is comparing the Einstein ring with the Einstein eye, so to speak. And then 46 is some pretty pictures of Einstein arcs. 47, you can see in 47 these arcs, and this is a real image. You see a bunch of arcs, and this is a cluster now, a cluster of galaxies. So galaxies will actually swarm together like a swarm of bees, kind of. And in that, when you have a galaxy cluster, it's dark matter mostly still, because we saw there was six times as much dark matter that you can't see by eye, but there's a lot of galaxies in it as well. And so you're going to see all this sort of lensing. And this is, we see this regularly. So in 48, I show what happens to a galaxy behind is it gets bent sort of tangentially, we call it. It gets bent along that circle compared to the foreground cluster. In 49, you can see this is simulation, not a real image here. So you can see the center of the cluster and the background galaxies and the galaxies behind it are very distorted. So the center of the cluster is in the lower left. And in the upper right, you don't see it by eye as clearly there, right? But if you, on the right-hand side, if you average the shape of all those galaxies, they would actually average out to those lines in the upper right. You see those two lines that look kind of like chopsticks. And that's what we do. We stack them together. That's what weak lensing is. All the images I was showing you before or in the lower left where you see it very clearly with your eye, that's the domain of strong lensing. So you see it's a continuum, but you tend to do analysis on these two things in quite different ways. So the average shape there on slide 50 is that red line. So in slide 51 is a plot I made of what this shows is the vertical axis is the effect that sort of the amount of bending, and then the horizontal axis is the distance from the center of the cluster that is acting as a lens. As you look out, the amount of lensing is less and less as you go out. Okay, and this is in another unit. We use arc minutes. In slide 52, so dark matter and lensing, slide 53, reconstructing the lens. So as I've said, gravity lenses light, and so we can use the lensed image of the galaxies to reconstruct the mass of the lens. And slide 54 is Hubble image of cluster of galaxies, and we want to see how much mass there is in this cluster. So in 55, what you see is you see a reconstruction of the mass. So from the lensing, I've skipped a lot of steps here, but from the amount of bending, we know where the galaxies are already, and we also, from strong lensing constraints, we can constrain how much mass those galaxies have. So those are the really sharp peaks, right? All those needle-like peaks, those are the galaxies. The underlying smoother distribution that they're on top of, that's the amount of dark matter, which is smoothly distributed because we believe it's particles that are just smoothly distributed through the cluster of galaxies, and that are particles, by the way, that are going through us all the time. This is what all astrophysicists believe, or most. Because either you have to modify gravity or they're particles that are going through us and don't interact very much, just like neutrinos, if you've heard of those. We do see them with big detectors, but we don't see them typically in normal detectors because they don't interact very much. So we reconstruct this mass of the galaxy cluster. So in 56, this is a really cool mass map that was made as people looked at the amount of lensing in as you went back in time from us. As you went back in time from us towards the beginning of the universe. And so you see this mass map of everything, you know. So it's dark matter and normal matter, and it's 3D mass maps, kind of cool. Dark energy, if we go to slide 58, what I'm showing there is equals 7 to 0. So z equals 0 is now, and then we use the term redshift as you go to higher z. You have less, so you're looking farther back in time. Things are less clustered. And then as you have time to build up structure, things fall into, gravitational wells, and they build up. And the lambda, it's like an anti-gravity force. It's pushing things apart. And so by measuring the amount of how much galaxies are able to gain structure, gain mass towards z equals zero over time, we are able to get a handle on how much lambda was pushing them apart earlier. And so that's a way that galaxy clusters can tell us about this lambda cosmological constant. There's many other ways. I work on galaxy clusters, so I'm emphasizing that, but there are many other ways. Okay, so coming close to the end, so 59, gravitational lensing is slack. So DES, Dark Energy Survey, is a camera on a telescope that's working down in Chile right now. Slide 60, LSST is the future. This is going to be an amazing camera and telescope. This is going to be an eight meter aperture. And the biggest telescopes on Earth now are 10 meters, and it's going to be the biggest camera on Earth. So it will take an image of the entire sky every 3 days, of the entire sky that is visible to it, deeper than has ever been done, certainly from the ground. So it's going to be really pretty impressive, and we expect to see great output from this. And I work on that telescope, actually, on simulations for it. On slide 61 are some other upcoming lensing surveys. So some are in space, some are on the ground. And LBT, I have this cool image on 62 just because I've stood on the platform of that telescope and really enjoyed it. I've been very awed by the universe standing there, so it's a really cool telescope. So the summary, 63, lensing is an amazing probe. Galaxy clusters give us some of the strongest evidence for dark matter. I talked about galaxies earlier, but galaxy clusters do as well. Lensing can constrain theories of dark energy. And summary 2, 64, DES and LSST will allow us to probe deeper than before ever. 65, Gravelins 3. spacewarps.org, I'd be interested if anyone participated in that. And that's, citizen science, we will say, for strong lens identification. That's closed right now, but we expect to have, you can see the results there, and we expect in the future to have more things like it. And so slide 66, I just like these quotes, and this is the point at, in an in-person presentation, I show that pale blue dot video sometimes just because I really like the way that Carl Sagan approached science. And that's a quote by Einstein: the cosmic religion, religious feeling, is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research, in the New York Times Magazine way back when. And that is it. So there we go.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mandy. Sure. Now, I'm sure there's going to be many questions, so let's kick off our QA session. Let's open up our lines to the listeners. Operator, if you could tell folks how to call in with their questions.
Absolutely. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Make sure to unmute your phone and record your name clearly. If you decide to withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Again, to ask a question, press star 1. It will take a moment for the questions to come through. Please stand by.
Okay.
Oh, and while we wait for the first question, I have a brief one. Just on the Space Warps website, do you happen to know when they'll be reopening it, or?
I don't know the exact time. I can ask Phil. I think, well, I would estimate within the next couple of years.
Okay.
Data coming in from DES, and we're supposed to be able to use that data on it, and I think the data they used before was either Sloan or CFHTLS, so DS data is coming in right now, so let's estimate next year. So, you know, if people want to check in yearly, and you know, what I could do is if you have a list of folks who listen or you know, just how you put out on the Night Sky Network, once I know, Dave, I can let you know. You can put it out there.
We can definitely put it in a follow-up article. That'd be awesome.
Cool.
Cool.
We do have a question from Ramakash. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Basically, I was wondering, like, you know, just like gravitational lensing, and that's done by dark matter or, you know, matter for, as a fact that matter and dark matter, I think, you know, does gravitational lensing. But what about, like, you know, dark energy? Can it do the delensing effect? Like, you know, instead of curving towards the mass, or is it possible that it may deflect in the other way?
Yeah, people ask this, and it's an interesting question. So what we believe about dark energy is that it's constant in distribution. So it's kind of like if you're shooting a ray through some sort of, you know, homogeneous fluid, excuse me, it won't bend one way or the other. You know, if you were, so I guess the way to think of it is if you have layers of a layer of water where it gets denser towards bottom, it's continuous density gradient, and it's much denser towards bottom, and you shoot a ray of light there, or even through the atmosphere, which gets denser towards the bottom, radio waves refract in the atmosphere, and things will bend towards the more dense side. But if you shoot it through something that is isotropic and homogeneous, so the same in all directions, then it just has no way to tell one way or the other. And all our experiments so far indicate this is the case, that dark energy has no clustering, has no preference, so there is no way for a light ray to know what to do. In theory, you're right, any clustering of energy would do that, but so far, in fact, that's one of the pieces of evidence that we don't see any, say, lensing in empty space, you know, indicates that dark energy is not clustering. So hope that answers the question.
So basically, like, you know, the clustering is what magnifies, like, dark energy or normal matter, for the fact, you know, it can cluster. Because of the clustering effect, it can actually magnify, and we'll be able to know through the lensing effect, like Einstein ring or arc, whatever. But if it was like dark energy, the light ray that's coming to us, we wouldn't be able to know whether it was part of something that got deflected in a different way or not, right?
Yeah, that is correct, that in theory you don't know, you know, where the original object was. And so all the galaxies, all the faraway ones, you know, where there has been lensing, there we actually know that they, by simulations, they are deflected. We use the term arc minutes, you know, like quite a bit away from where they typically are. But, yeah, so we never know their original location. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, now, can I ask a different question related to, I mean, in the same right now, or do I have to come back in the queue and ask at a different point, time?
That I don't know, but we should probably give a couple other people
give
a chance
another,
to talk. Yeah.
Okay,
then.
Good. Nice questions, Ram Prakash.
Our next question is from Colleen. Your line is open. Please check your mute function, Colleen.
On slide 19, talking about the smallest scales, the vacuum is a writhing mass of particles. Could you maybe explain that a little more?
Well, this is one of the theories. So there is let me go back to slide 19. There is this theory that says, so there's these things called, well, virtual particles. And have you ever heard of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle?
Yes, yes, definitely.
So what it says is that you're allowed to sort of create things in empty space as long as you're allowed to create them for the amount of time that is inversely proportional to how massive, how much energy they have. It says delta E, delta A, delta E, delta T equals a constant. And so, where T is a time and E is energy. So you can create all these particles in space, and maybe if you have, maybe those particles will have some kind of real effect. They can't really stay in space for a long period of time, but maybe they have some effect on things near them for a little while. And so there's a thing called the Casimir effect when you put two plates together that, because of this, the virtual particles being there, there's virtual particles everywhere, but they're, because the plates are close together, they can't, we could say there's certain modes. In empty space, you can create all kinds of virtual particles. Between the plates, because there's only a certain amount of space, you're only allowed to create certain kinds. And what that ultimately does is it creates a little bit of pressure. It's this very subtle pressure, and people have gone out and measured it, and they've seen it. So they've seen, and you can look this up on Wikipedia, the Casimir effect. They've seen this, and so people think, well, maybe if you have these particles in space, maybe they also are creating a certain vacuum energy density that we're not, and we don't know how to calculate that level right now, but maybe in the future we will. So that's where that theory comes from, basically, because I skipped through it quickly. We don't really know. We really don't know, but that's essentially
it. No, that's good.
Okay,
great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm, thank you, Colleen.
Our next question is from Tom Totten. Your line is open.
Hi there. Thanks for the lecture. On dark matter, has there been any proof that if dark matter particles hit each other, that they create an extra photon, and therefore you'd see an extra light around galaxies, and that'd be another way to measure dark matter?
Yeah. So the what you just described is usually described. It's usually called indirect dark matter detection, as opposed to direct. Some people may be wondering. We search for them on the Earth. People make big wafers of silicon and germanium, or huge liquid xenon detectors. Many different materials, because they're hoping, like with neutrinos, which were only actually discovered directly detected 25 years after they were hypothesized for momentum conservation reasons, that we'll see dark matter in the same way on the Earth. And that's really, until you see it, it's hard for people to fully believe it. And so what you just described is indirect, and there's a lot of astrophysicists that want and look. So I mentioned that Fermi telescope near the beginning. That's one of the things it's looking for, is maybe in the centers of galaxies, maybe, dark matter does cluster there, as opposed to dark energy, which does not cluster, as far as we've seen. And so those dark matter particles would annihilate, and they would send us photons, gamma rays, that we would see. So maybe that happens there. Maybe that happens in what are called dwarf galaxies around us, like the Magellanic Clouds. And so people are looking for that all the time. That's, as you can imagine, a very difficult thing to disentangle from background because, for example, there's a black hole at the center of, you know, all big galaxies, which is doing a lot of emission in X-ray and some in gamma ray as well. And at the center of the galaxy tends to be a pretty messy place to do observations. So people do look, but there's been no clear, you know, incontrovertible evidence yet.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you, Tom.
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Stuart Myers. Your line is open.
Oh, hello. Thanks for the presentation tonight.
Sure.
I was just wondering if you had any, if your opinion, if it's possible, if you think it's there's a good chance that we'll detect dark matter particles with the accelerators that we currently possess.
This is always an interesting thing when you ask a scientist their opinion because, I wouldn't bet lots on it, let's say. I would not bet my house. I certainly hope, we all hope that we will find really cool things. We have no... There's two things I would say. There are theories of there's some theories that gravity is changed. I alluded to that briefly. Things called modified gravity. We really don't believe it's that for a few reasons I could talk about, especially because this colliding cluster that showed a separation between matter and dark matter called the bullet cluster. So we most astrophysicists would strongly believe that it is particles. But unfortunately, there's a type of particle called a gravitino and others too that only interact gravitationally, and you would never see them interact with matter in another way. You know, neutrinos don't interact much, but when they do, there's 600 trillion neutrinos that go through us every second from the sun. If the sun's on the other side of the Earth, they go straight through the Earth and they go straight through us. But if you build a 50,000-ton tank of water, as they did in Japan, you see a few of these a day. And we have other detectors in the Earth, around the Earth. We do hope that the dark matter would interact so we could see it. Certainly those people work on it directly, on that direct detection. But I would not guarantee that we will see it. The next generation, I'll say, within the next 10 years, it's sort of an order of magnitude bigger detectors. And if they don't see any signal at all, I think a lot of people will have to throw in the towel and go to other models or say it's gravitino only and we will have to look in other directions for, insight about it. That's what I would say about it.
All right. Well, I read just tonight, a little just before I got onto this conference, about some results from that AMS instrument
uh-huh.
that they have mounted on the space station.
Right.
And some of the people studying the results from that believe that the particle they're talking about is huge in terms of mass.
Yeah, so let's put a little pause on confirming AMS results because I saw those results came out and had a friend email them to me, and they are not, confirmed at all. And
I didn't say they were.
Unfortunately, there's, I do talk about science, but I like to sort of somehow distinguish between, more conclusive science or stuff that's really... stuff we know, stuff that looks conclusive, and then really speculative stuff. And so I would not call that, use the term on shell, or I would not call that confirmed by any means. So,
nope.
Keep your eyes open, but,
right.
with all these kinds of things, the next few months or year or two.
I brought that up because it would indicate that you're most likely, if that bears out, you're most likely not going to see anybody create dark matter particles and
yeah.
accelerate.
That's true, and there are candidates like that, and you're right about that. LHC at CERN has not seen any evidence either yet, that they've created any dark matter candidates, so we'll just keep our eyes open on all these arenas.
Okay.
Our last question from the night comes from Ram Prakash. Thank you. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. So I was wondering, you know, in one of the slides, and I've also heard about it, that from Newton's laws, you know, deriving the, you know, the deflection angle when light ray passes through a gravitational field like the sun or a star galaxy, you know, alpha or beta, you know, it says something like Gm by RC square, but, you know, that's, is that the Newton's wave or
yeah.
It's actually 2Gm by RC square per Einstein's equations?
That's right. So Gm over RC squared, where m in that case is the mass of the deflector. I actually misspoke. I realized earlier it doesn't bending. It doesn't care how massive your particle going by is. It only cares, just like orbital motion doesn't care about the mass of the planet. It only cares about the mass of the central object to first order. So
GM over
RC squared. That's as per Newton, and the 2 GM over RC squared. That's as per Einstein. That's right.
So the thing is, I was wondering, like, you know, instead of making, I mean, Newton actually first was the one who actually made this constant, right, the gravitational constant, but he didn't find the value unless, you know, until Henry Cavendish, you know, found the value, and then, you know, we got better estimates, you know, more, it was still approximated, but I think recently it was again found, you know, to be more accurate, and still I think we still have an approximation there, right? It's not still fully.
Yeah, but, we, you know, we have an approximation to every number. You know, we never have infinite number of digits. So, but we know it pretty well. Yeah, we know it pretty well, G. But if your question is maybe, like, are we being able to tell deviations from Einsteinian gravity by, you know, there are experiments on Earth that try to measure that, you know, deviations from Einstein. And so we haven't seen that. Everything we've seen indicates that Einsteinian gravity, which reduces to Newtonian gravity, is, you know, so, you know, let's say perfect as far as we can tell. So is totally accurate within our domain of measurement so far, which is always only so far, right?
You know, instead of using Einstein's equation, I mean, yeah, Einstein's equation is still... And, you know, the small equation Gm by RC square, 2Gm, is really like an approximation of the overall field equations, right, which are a little bit complicated than this, you know.
Yeah.
But Newton's equation is a straightforward one, you know, basically. So what I was wondering is, you know, instead of making the G as a gravitational constant, we can make it something like a gravitational factor, and depending on where the gravitational field is, the strength of the gravitational field, we can actually double that number from 6.67 times 10 power 11, and then, you know, just have it as 6.67, and then that way we don't even have to use Einstein's equation. Like, we can use it, like, you know, in where it's required, and but, you know, not in all the cases. We can just use Newton's, making the G not a constant, but, you know, like a form factor or something like that.
Yeah, no, those are good ideas. I think they'd probably take longer than we have time to discuss here, but people do think some on things like that, but I think you're thinking in the right direction, so yeah, you should keep thinking in those ways, I would say.
Yep.
So, yeah.
And we actually have to wrap up for tonight, but thank you for your questions, and thank you, everyone. Yep, so that is all the time we have for this evening, so thank everyone for calling in and listening to this wonderful presentation. And a huge thanks to you, Mandeep, for giving us so much of your time and for this awesome presentation and your great answers.
Thank you, and thanks really for the questions. I appreciated those, and Ram Prakash, Stewart, and everyone there asked really great questions. So thanks so much, everyone.
So that's all for tonight. You can find this telecon, along with many others in the Night Sky Network, under Astronomy Activities. Just look for telecon as the keyword. Tonight's presentation with the full audio and written transcript will be posted with some more notes and updates by the end of this week, so by tomorrow. And good night, everyone, and keep looking up.
Keep looking up. All right. Take care.
You too.
Everybody.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.